Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare and is used with permission of the artist. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Board of Directors meeting will be held on Monday, May 20th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive, taking place now through May 25th. Your contribution goes towards postmodern, avant-garde, alternative radio. Donate now by going to bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you.
KBOO.
الخرز ترد العين سلوان وقلبي من الهجران ما يصير سلوان وعين سمسم
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. If you don't know, that's my greeting because some of you guys are tuning in on KBOO.FM and some of you are tuning in on 90.7 FM. That's KBOO Community Radio in Portland. This is your host, Mike Crenshaw, for Culture in Motion, your once monthly show, where we talk about the intersection between politics, art, activism, music, and just the intersections there. We were just listening to Dalal Abu Amne. Dalal is an Israeli Arab Palestinian artist. This was given to me by a guest that we're going to have on later, a local Palestinian comrade named Rhonda. And Rhonda was kind enough to share Abu's work. Abu is a woman artist, and even though she lives in Israel, she's Palestinian Arab, and you can read about her online. Her name is spelled Dalal Abu Amneh, and May 15th is commemoration of Nakba Day. We're in a beautiful time of year, and we're going to talk about the Nakba a little bit with our guests, Rhonda, later on the show. And between now and 10 days from now, May 15th being Nakba Commemoration Day, and KBOO doing work to recognize that in reflection of Palestinian liberation and the need for a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, and an end to the genocide that's been taking place, some would say for over 75 years, others would say since October 7th. But we're proud to be doing this work down here and platforming narratives that are not going to center that of the oppressor. So I wanted to play some Palestinian music at the top of the show. And also, you know, 10 days from now, pardon me for being a little bit loose and going on tangents, but 10 days from now is African Liberation Day. So I'm going to give a shout out to the comrades from All African People's Revolutionary Party all over the world. Because they're going to be doing African Liberation Day down there in Oakland on May 25th. I was invited, but I'm not going to be able to make it this year. But AAPRP always puts in a lot of good work to bring community together for Pan-African, you know, community, Pan-African socialist consciousness. And before we get into some more content, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the intersections, you know, between different systems of oppression and the struggles of different people all over the world for liberation. We know that our folks who are struggling, you know, first peoples, people of color, working class people, poor and oppressed people worldwide, are people full of love and people full of culture and people with dynamic, broad forms of expression. And that's all part of our lives and our existence, in addition to the trauma and the struggles that we face. But I think it's important that, you know, when we talk about people who are struggling against empire, that we remember that the violence of the empire is not the only thing that exists. It's not the only story that exists, and that our music, our movement, our thought, our consciousness, our way of building community and joint struggle is more resilient, more beautiful than the violence that we endure and persevere. So that said, there's a brother that I consider to be a mentor, even though I never met him. Some of you might know him as Stokely Carmichael, who was recognized for his participation in the Student Nonviolent coordinating committee who later relocated to Africa, Guinea-Bissau. And, you know, he eventually transitioned his name, you know, into Kwame Ture. And Kwame Ture was one of the founding fathers of the African People's Revolutionary Party. And if you look up Kwame Ture online and or you read books about him, you're going to see that he's one of the most clear-headed, brilliant thinkers that the struggle for people's liberation globally has ever produced. And I just love to listen to him talk. He's not as popular as Martin Luther King Jr. Or Angela Davis or Malcolm X or El-Haj Malik al-Shabazz in many circles, but he's still a giant amongst thinkers. And I want to listen to a little bit of what he's talking about from a previous speech. So I'm going to cue that up. And I want to say that the reason I think this speech is important is it's, you know, it's a 6-minute clip we're going to listen to. He's not only talking about scientific socialism, but at the top of the clip, he talks about the Palestinian struggle for liberation. And he says something very important. He talks about how the narrative that we see in a corporate mainstream media in the West is a narrow narrative that is censored and curated to exclude the voice and the experience and the stories of Palestinian people. And it's interesting that he says, you'll hear how he says it, but what we've seen since October 7th is actually more of an effort and more of a presence, more of an effort to center the voices of Palestinian people who are surviving and enduring and seeking liberation, this current and ongoing genocide and struggle, right? But also, we've just seen the presence of it more. And so because of that, again, what we're starting to see in the administration of the federal government of the U.S. and other countries in the West that are U.S. allies is that there's this conversation over banning TikTok and making TikTok illegal. So we've gone from a situation in a short amount of time where Palestinian voices were deliberately censored, intentionally censored and marginalized and repressed in media, to a time where, because of social media, these narratives have been coming forward more. And that's the reason that TikTok is being threatened with being banned in the United States. So let's just check out something from a while back. I think this is 1992. I'll cue this up here. Again, this would be Kwame Ture. Previously known as Stokely Carmichael. And it's going to take me a second here. For those of you who don't know, the Nakba, let me say a little bit more about that, was the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in mandatory Palestine during the 1948 Palestine War through their violent displacement and dispossession of land, property, and belongings, along with the destruction of their society, culture, identity, political rights, and national aspirations. 750,000 plus Palestinian Arabs were expelled from land which is now Israel. Some of us would recognize that as occupied Palestine. So bear with me for a moment. And also, if anybody wants to become a member of KBOO, please feel free to do so. You can go to kboo.fm and you can donate, you can become a member, any way you want to support the kind of programming that you hear that are going to be where we're going to be highlighting perspectives that you're not going to hear in mainstream media. So almost got this clip up. Here we go.
When they talk about the struggle in Palestine, it's just a Zionist, never the Palestine. I mean, never. It presents things only as one-sided, that things are only one side. When they talk about the Indians and the cowboys, you just get the cowboy side, not the Indian side. We want to make this aspect of constant struggle clear. Of course, the capitalist system, of course, will confuse you. The other day, someone was sitting down looking at a movie. It was a movie about how these, you know, the Jewish people had suffered, and now because they're suffering, they were going to Palestine, a Zionist picture. So it was on television. So I walked out the room. Someone said, oh, you know, you are so racist. I said, I'm racist. Yes, this is a story. It's just a story about people suffering and just their suffering. And you think, I said, when last have you seen a picture of a Palestinian family suffering on television? You will never see it. You will never see it because they don't want to work up your sentiments to support the Palestinians. So the only stories you see are suffering stories of them all the time, all the time, all the time. One-sided view of life is given everywhere, this one-sided view of life. We must come to look at the other side. We must come to investigate the other side. And when you investigate the other side falls. I told you that I was a socialist, and I am. I must tell you this because capitalism just confuses you. The other day I told a brother I was socialist. He said, "You still socialist?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "But it fell." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, you didn't hear about it." I said, "No, I didn't hear about it." He said, "It collapsed." I said, "Oh." He said, "You hear about the Soviet Union? They're gone." I said, "Really?" I said, "Listen. I said, you mustn't get confused. You know, capitalism doesn't just rape your labor and rip off your resources. It deforms your thinking. It deforms your thinking." I told the man, "You're not thinking." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I saw it happen. It's finished." I said, "You never judge a system by its adherents. You never judge any system by its believers. You judge it by its principles." He said, "I don't understand what you're talking about." I said, "All I'm saying to you, brother, is you don't judge socialism by socialists." He said, "You're talking double talk." I said, "Am I?" He said, "If you tell me that you can't judge socialism by socialists, who you judge it by?" I said, "Let me ask you one question. Do you judge Christianity by Christians?" If you judge Christianity by Christians, it fell with Judas. And if it didn't fall with Judas, so many, many Christians in so many, many ways every day violates every principle of Christianity. When you judge a system, you judge it by its principles. Christianity has been betrayed everywhere. The Pope used it to divide the world. Slave masters use it to bring about slavery. But me, I will never condemn Christianity. I know its principles. The principles are just, therefore eternal. Any man, any woman, any time wishing to live a just life can pick up the principles, imitate them, and live them. So it is with socialism. You must not get confused. Socialism hasn't gone anywhere. It has been betrayed, yes. But betrayal doesn't mean collapse. Perhaps they get confused because at least Judas had the dignity after betraying Christianity to hang himself. Yeah, Gorbachev is still running around the world picking up pieces of silver. Must be clear here, not confused. I'm a socialist. One other thing I must tell you now. They confuse people about socialism. Brother the other day said, "I ain't no socialist." I said, "Why not, brother?" He said, "Cause it's a white thing." I said, "Oh, really? You see, Europe tries to make believe that everything that comes out of the world comes out of Europe." I told the man, I said, "Socialism ain't no white thing." He said, "Yes, it is." He said, "Karl Marx discovered it." I told him, "Karl Marx never discovered socialism. He cannot. You call the laws of gravity Newton's laws. I'm sure there's a mnemonic device to help you on your quizzes. But you certainly cannot believe that Isaac Newton can found that a body falls at the rate of 32 feet per second squared per second squared. He can't find this. He can't discover it. He cannot invent this. He can only observe it and record it, discover the law. If I'm sitting in Timbuktu in Africa, and I've never heard of Sir Isaac Newton, and I'm conducting any experiments with gravity, I will come to the same conclusion that he does. A body in motion tends to stay in motion unless stopped by an outside force. He cannot invent this. He can only observe it and record it. Karl Marx did not invent socialism. If I'm sitting in Libya, in the desert, and I'm doing any research with capital and labor without ever having heard of Karl Marx, I will come to the same conclusion that he did. That any time capital seeks to dominate labor, there'll be a ruthless, uncompromising struggle on the part of labor until it comes to crush capital and dominate it. This is a fact. My history demonstrates that. We came here as chattel slaves for centuries. We fought and fought and fought until we crushed it. Now we're just slave of the wage, and now we've got to rise up and crush that one. That's to declare that Karl Marx didn't invent socialism. It's there for all to see. Karl Marx's great contribution to the world was in the area of historical materialism and dialectical materialism, something you need to know if you know about socialism. But since you don't know about socialism, you don't even know the words. And not only does the enemy keep you ignorant, you stay ignorant. You won't ever go read a book about socialism. Why read a book about socialism? They already told me in my class it ain't no good. You will not even read a book about socialism. Why, you don't even read a book about your history. We come to inspire you to learn We come to tell you that when you come to serve a people, you must know as much as you can. The more you know, the better able you are to serve the people.
All right, y'all.
Forget who hurt you.
Love that clip. Love that clip. That's 1992, Kwame Ture speaking. And in alignment with that, there's a couple of things coming up I want to let people know about. Live hip-hop show, The Get Together, put on by Runway Productions. That's going to be at the Star Theater Friday night. There's going to be a lot of good artists on the bill. Versatile, Blacktacular, Chicharrones, Sirens Echo, DJ Cliff, myself, and others. And I just got back from, shout out to Mobile Stern and the It Did Happen Here crew. I just got back from a 10-city tour of the Southeast, touring on behalf of the book and the podcast, It Did Happen Here. And I'm going to be speaking about building community safety without relying on police. And that's going to be Wednesday, May 29th, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at PSU. That's the Urban Center Parsons Gallery, room 212, 516 Southwest Mill Street at Portland State University. It's also going to be streaming online, but if you follow Walida and Marisha or at Mike Crenshaw on Instagram, those flyers will be up in stories and so forth. So just letting people know about those events that are happening in the community. Again, that's a lot of local live hip-hop at a show called The Get Together this Friday night, 9 p.m. Doors are probably 8 p.m. at the Star Theater downtown. And then Wednesday, May 29th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at PSU, talking about It Did Happen Here and anti-fascist people's history and building community safety without police. And going forward, we've got a guest coming up in a few minutes on Culture in Motion. But before we get into that, I just wanted to, you know, share a little bit of art with you guys in reflection. You might have heard the piece we did featuring Tony Hill. I'll be performing this live. I performed it and played it on the show a couple of times. Last time it got cut short, so this time I'm just going to do it a cappella. Because I believe, you know, it's my role and responsibility to speak to the issues at hand. There's a genocide inside your mind, your vibe, opinions, and decisions, and if we criticize it, you scream it's anti-Semitism, a gimmick. It puts a blemish on religion. Play the victim, fit the image, but you can't diminish wisdom. Who is it? Who did it? Who had these crimes committed? Inquisit, which is it, wicked, indifferent, or complicit? Missiles hit these kids, and if they live, their skins and limbs are missing. Their intent is to get rid of them or keep them pent up in a prison. This isn't rocket science, a quantum physics, but Zionism. Taxes fund attacks. Who manufactured all the bombs that did it? A fraction of a system. Killing hundreds by the minute. Deny the fact that it exists, but when you listen, they admit it. It's not promotional, but cultural, mostly non-negotiable, all over the globe and coast to coast, psychological, emotional, thoroughly gifted, neurolinguistic, explicit. Amidst the horrific, this is exquisite, terrific. I work hard. I play hard. I try to stay far from the graveyard. I make my art and play my part. Try to play it smart when the danger starts. Stay sharp or get torn apart. Fatal forces, torch and targets, no remorse, morbid darkness, corpses, carcass on the carpet. 5 a.m. on the rides today. Meditate, take time to pray. Time to ride. I got to shine a light. I got to hop on a bike and ride away. Goals to reach. Youth to teach. Land about a chilling peace. That's the dream. That's the vision. Apathy, that's forbidden. The journey is the destination. I'm grounded, facing escalation. You react. I relax. Healthy self-preservation. And in the hook, Tony Hill will sing, there's a fire in the sky, not meant to keep them warm. Children in the street, dancing through the storm. Will we watch them weep and act as if there's nothing wrong? Can you hear them sing, screaming freedom song? And that is something I wrote. I haven't released it yet, but I'm hoping to release it soon. In you know, recognition and reflection of what's been happening. It's something that I hope we get to see the end of soon. And I hope to see liberated Palestinian land and people in my lifetime, and hopefully sooner than later. It's easy to feel discouraged. I want to give a shout of encouragement to the people all over the United States and all over our city and cities all across this country who've been standing up in the streets for months now, you know, and pressuring elected officials and participating in mass forms of mutual aid and having encampments at universities. Because all this work is what makes things change, and it doesn't happen quickly. But it does happen. It's brought attention to things in a way that I've actually been enlightened by a lot of the information. And I'm just one person. And I know a lot of us have been enlightened by the information that's being brought forth by research and by people, many brave journalists, many of whom have been assassinated and murdered in cold blood by Israeli occupation forces. And many who are still alive and still bringing us firsthand coverage and trying to save lives and get the word out and the visuals, you know, the documentation of what's happening. So these are life-changing events. And again, shout out, respect to everybody who's been standing up and fighting and sacrificing their time and their efforts. This is Culture in Motion. I'm gonna transition into our interview with Rhonda. And thank you for listening. Continue to support KBOO. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are on earth, whatever time zone you're in. This is your once monthly show on KBOO.FM, KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM on the dial here in Portland, Oregon, where we talk about the intersection between art, culture, activism, politics, and music. And I'm your host, Mike Crenshaw. This is Culture in Motion. It's good to be tuning in and talking to a very special guest today, Rhonda. As part of our recognition of the Nakba, something that happened in history where 700,000 Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their indigenous homelands, and we want to remember that. And we want to remember it in the context and in reflection of what's happening historically and currently to occupy Palestine. Rhonda, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So thanks for agreeing to join us today and talk about this history and how it relates to what's happening. Are you from Palestine?
I am not from Palestine, but my father was born in Palestine. Yes. And yeah, he moved here in to go to college, and he met my mom here. And yeah, but I have family still in Palestine and lots of family throughout the kind of the diaspora.
Okay. When did your father, what year was it when he migrated to the United States?
Probably would it be maybe 67, 68.
Did he live in other cities, or did he move directly to Portland?
He moved directly to Portland. He had a friend from school who was moving here, and he came here to go to PSU.
Wow, that's rare. A lot of people live around a few places before they wind up in Portland that I've met that migrate here from other countries.
I think it's interesting as well.
Yeah. So what year were you born?
I was born in 70.
Same. So we're the same age. Have you gone home to visit your ancestral homeland?
Yes. Yeah. When I was a kid, I did.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. How long did you stay?
We stayed for about 4 months, a little more than 4 months. The plan actually was to live there, but there wasn't really work for my dad there, so we came back to the U.S.
And how old were you then?
I was 9.
Were you, do you recall, like, in terms of the discussion around moving there, how you felt? Were you excited?
Yeah, I was excited. I felt excited. I don't remember feeling sad about leaving the U.S. or worried.
What are some of the things you can say based on, you know, what you remember as a 9-year old that are different, you know, about Palestine? And what city were you in Palestine?
Beit Hanina is where my family's from. When we got there, we came through the airport in Tel Aviv, and they immediately, you know, saw our name on our passports and pulled us aside and questioned us why we were here, why we were, why, what we were doing. You know, it was very like hostile. I remember as a child, there just being soldiers like on every street corner and, you know, with guns and green. And I also remember that, like, one of the things that I remember is my aunt was getting married, and I just remember my other aunt, like, you know, just grabbing a drum and started playing, and every, like, how musical they were and how free they were to be, to express themselves, like, musically, and like how kind of uninhibited they were in that way. I just remember that being such an something that was amazing to me. And when I was there, my aunt got married, but also in the village, if somebody gets, you know, if somebody's getting married, the whole village is invited, and they'll do like this big parade down the street, walk from like the bride's house to the groom's house, and everyone will join in, and there's like singing and chanting and people playing drums, and it's just this joyous culture. It was really like so beautiful.
And how long were you there again?
We were there for about 4 months.
So was it a disappointment to come back to the States?
Yeah, I think, I mean, especially like as I, in retrospect, you know, it was kind of a loss to me, you know, that connection. And I don't know what, yeah, I don't think I think I was kind of sad. I was sad to leave my grandparents for sure.
Yeah. And so you still have a lot of family in Palestine now?
Actually, I have only my dad is one of nine, and only his one brother lives in my grandparents' house, and his daughter, and so my cousin and my aunt and uncle live there. One of my aunts moved to Jordan, and then everybody else lives in the U.S.
And your family's migration to Jordan and to the U.S., is it a direct result of U.S. policy and Israel's occupation?
Yeah, I think it's just, it's really hard to live there. I mean, you know, you're living under apartheid. For instance, like when we were there, this was before they built the apartheid wall. We, you know, we're like 20 minutes drive from Ramallah, which is, you know, the bigger city by Beit Hanina, and it would take 20 minutes to drive there. Now at the checkpoints, it takes 2 hours. So every kind of aspect of ease is, you know, something, you know, things we take for granted are difficult and complicated. And that was, you know, the kind of life that they could have there. But I think also heartbreaking to leave your land and, you know, potentially lose that connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you describe what the land is like?
I remember there was my grandparents' house had a grape, like a big grape arbor. And we went to this other piece of land that my family also owned that had like apricot trees and pomegranates and lemons, and we saw lots of snakes, and you know, that the inside of the house is, you know, you see lizards and Yeah, it was beautiful. It was very, you know, it's pretty, like, back then it was still pretty fairly rural.
Yeah, yeah. Was it, so it's like a high desert kind of climate?
Yes, I believe so.
Uh-huh. I love that you described the snakes and the lizards, because those are two of my favorite things to see in a place. I think that when there's healthy snakes and lizards, then the place, that means that the land is healthy, because there's a thriving ecosystem with, like, layers of, you know, predator and prey and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I'm thank you for sharing all these things, because I think these details are contextual for those of us who haven't spent any time in Palestine and aren't familiar with the culture. And I wanted to also, you know, just have, like, a picture where we can sensually, like, feel things about Palestinian life, aside from trauma, because that's all we're seeing now, you know, since October 7th, even though this genocidal occupation has been going on, some would say for close to 100 years, others close to 75 years. I don't recall if I asked you this much this before, but the when they built the apartheid wall, what year was that? Over a series of years in different locations.
I don't really know the answer to that. Yeah, I'd have to look that up.
You shared with me yesterday that your father had experienced the Nakba.
Yes, he'll be 81 in August, so he would have been almost five. He has, you know, memory challenges now, so he doesn't really have as clear of a memory of it. But my aunt, who is 3 years older than him, so she would have been eight. She has shared with us what she remembers.
So that this happened in 1948. Can you describe to our listeners who might not know what the Nakba was or is?
I mean, Nakba means catastrophe, the catastrophe in Arabic, and it was the expulsion of the native Palestinians and the creation of the state of Israel on, you know, the already existing, on top of the existing Palestinian people and culture and infrastructure and land.
What, thank you. What, do you remember some of the stories that your father or aunt shared with you of the experience?
I can share with you the story specifically about that my aunt shared.
Okay.
Go ahead and I can read what she said. So my aunt was 8 years old in 1948 when the first Nakba happened. My grandparents took her and her siblings. It would have been four children. My aunt, two of my aunts, who are my dad's older sisters, my dad, and then his younger brother. So it would have been, you know, probably a 9-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 5-year-old, and maybe a 3-year-old, because my dad's younger brother's probably a few years younger than him. So four kids. So my grandparents took her and her siblings to a small town called Hizma, and they hid in a one-room apartment there. They walked to Hizma, which is not that far from Bet Hanina. I looked it up. It's like about 3 miles away. I looked it up just to see, and it says it's a 1 hour and 7 minute walk, but I think that is now taking into consideration that there's a checkpoint in between these two cities. My great-grandmother, Sabha, used to stand in line for bread every day. My mom remembers the men of the villages being lined up. This is my cousin telling me this. So my aunt remembers the men of the villages being lined up against the wall by the army and shot in a row. Many families had to flee and were never allowed to return. My grandparents came back, and so they were able to stay there. I think that part ended up being under the control of Jordan until until the Six-Day War, when they took it. And at that point, my dad's cousin was killed in 1967. He was killed by the Israeli army, and he left behind 8 children. So he was shot by the Israeli army while they were running away from them, and I'm not sure, they put him under a tree and covered him with leaves, and they went back to get his body and buried him a week later. So so my dad always has talked about his cousin, for sure. Like, that's something that he, you know, is fairly recent in his mind. He doesn't really talk too much about the Nakba, but I feel like it was one of those things that has been denied. I mean, if you read, like, if you watch the movie Tantura, which I've only seen, you know, little parts of these men who participated in these crimes and admit to it and laugh about it, that they did do things like line people up and shoot them, and they did, you know, rape women, and they stole, you know, and these, I don't think that there ever, this was ever acknowledged as truth until recently. And I know it definitely wasn't in Israel. So.
Yeah. I'm just taking a second to sit with that. I think anybody who is human, you know, with a conscience would be triggered in terms of, like, their, you know, I'm triggered in terms of my own memories of injustice and trauma, right? And so it's easy for me to imagine the type of pain and rage and sadness that one would feel being subjected to this kind of thing. So when I see clips of that movie, Tantura, and I see these guys laughing about it, it really just, like, defies logic to me.
Yeah.
Like, the lack of compassion for another human being and for, you know, millions of people is, it's hard for me to accept or understand or respect, you know?
Yeah.
In the wake of that, you know, growing up in a household and having a father who survived such, having a Palestinian identity culturally and ethnically, how did your father talk about your relationship, his relationship, your family's relationship to Israel as a state?
I mean, we were, it's such a great, like, injustice. It was, I think he was very full of rage about it, understandably. I think he was very frustrated with the fact that nobody could see anything from a Palestinian perspective. I mean, the media was such that there was a story that served, I guess it's that's served empire. I don't know, the government that, you know, that we were just terrorists and we were suicide bombers and we were, and there was no context for any of the injustices that had happened to the Palestinian people. And, you know, I just don't think that there was, it got to the point where, like, any, for me, I guess my experience is that whenever you would, you know, bring up your identity as a Palestinian, then people would, you'd have to explain, like, why are you, like, what's wrong with your people? Why are they doing this? And nobody, you know, even would ever believe you when you were to say, like, no, this is actually what is happening, you know. Yeah,
I recently watched part of a documentary about the decades-long curation of a narrative that was done by leaders in the ad industry, utilizing the psychology of the ad industry, to brand Israel in the way that we've, most of us in the United States have grown up and thought of Israel, most of us of a certain age. I've known that Israel has been engaged in a violent conflict and brutal occupation. I came to understand that maybe 15 years ago. Prior to that, I would see things in the news and I just didn't understand what was going on, but I just knew there was a conflict between Israel and Palestine and a conflict between Israel and Lebanon.
Yeah.
And I would see pictures and news stories of leaders shaking hands and talking about a peace accord of some sort. But then the conflict would continue. And it's happening to this day. What do you envision happening going forward? And are you in community with people where you can collectively support each other, like through what's happening now?
I mean, I think it's hard to be in community because I don't think it requires like a lot of teaching or a lot of, it can be exhausting. Also, I think a lot of people don't care, you know, and it's not something that's discussed until it comes up for whatever reason. And then you're like, oh, okay. Like, this is you have this opinion, or you actually don't really care about the fact that, you know, you can look away from these atrocities that are happening and not be affected by them. So it's kind of informative. I do, you know, like I'm in community with, I find like, you know, people, just other people, not specifically Palestinian people, because there's not a huge Palestinian community here. I think other oppressed people like get it, you know, it's people like, you know, who see it, know it, and that's the truth, you know, like only the people who have experienced that in their own lives recognize it, I feel like, oftentimes.
Yeah. I asked you this question about, you know, what do you see happening? Because I'm always trying to figure it out. You know, when I was a kid, I was made to watch this network TV miniseries called The Holocaust. And we learned about the Jewish Holocaust that the Nazis orchestrated in Europe and subsequent anti-Semitism. We never learned about anything having to do with Palestinian people. One of the things I remember seeing on the Holocaust series was, you know, I was a child, I was probably like 6 or 7 years old. And one of the things I remember seeing was these train loads of Jewish people being loaded onto these box cars and then shipped to concentration camps. And there would be these armed Nazi guards. So in a sense, this forced evacuation, this ethnic cleansing, forced displacement is reminiscent of what we're seeing happening in Palestine, reminiscent of what happened with the Nakba. But during those scenes, I always, as a kid, I was like, since there's hundreds of Jewish people being loaded onto these cars and there's only a few guards, why don't they overtake the guards? You know, and that just, I don't have an answer to that question, right?
Yeah.
But it's just something that when I think about what's happening now, I think about the United States and Israel as those, and then, you know, they have other allies, NATO countries and so forth, but many of which are also settler colonial states. But, you know, these other nations of the world outnumber the United States and Israel.
Yes. I'm amazed at how we have the veto power the U.S. has in the U.N. is just, how do we have supreme power of the world? I need to find out how that came about and why it still is, because it's crazy that we continue to veto ceasefire after ceasefire. And yeah, I mean, I would say I also remember we watched a videos of the Holocaust. I remember in middle school, and I remember also seeing those horrible images of, you know, those starving bodies, those thin bodies that were being starved. And I didn't think why, I mean, I thought, why did nobody help them? Why did nobody stand up? Like, how could we as humans do that to other humans, you know? And now I see that, you know, and it's amazing to me, you know, that happens, and that humans are, I don't know, so caught up in their own thing, or I don't know why it happens. But yeah, that sat with me my whole life, in fact. You know, those pictures were very traumatizing, actually. I mean, as a child for me, and you know, now it's come back around to that.
Yeah, and the more I learn, it also feels like it's never stopped.
Yeah, I think you're
but
right.
But the exposure of it has been curated.
Yeah.
On one side and censored on the other side. Right. And just like there are people that are Nazis and anti-Semitic who will deny that the Holocaust ever happened, there's a real-time Holocaust happening that's being denied currently.
That's true. Yes, it's a good point.
And, you know, what about other parallel Holocausts that we don't understand anything about, that because they're happening in places that aren't getting news coverage?
Yeah, that's
right.
True.
So, you know, I do have these larger questions about human nature. Mm-hmm. And it evidently it is in our nature to be monsters to each other.
Yeah.
It's also in our nature to be in harmony with each other.
Yes.
You know, and I understand that the history of the region, what people would call the Middle East or Central Asia, or Western Asia or Northwestern Asia, you know, what the different terms that talk about this geographic area, that people of different faiths have lived together without being at war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that these wars are actually being manipulated because Western powers are wanting control of resources.
Yes, that's very true.
Have you ever seen this documentary called Exterminate All the Brutes?
Mm-mm.
It's worth watching. And this is for the listeners, too. Raoul Peck did it. He's a Haitian director and producer. And one of the things he talks about, and I'm not going to quote the year right, but there was a time in which the church, the European church, the Catholic Church, got wind of the spice route that was controlled by Arab peoples. And that was the beginning of the imperial and colonial conflicts between Europeans and Arab peoples. So I say that to say that I think there's a broader historical context. Right now, we think about it in terms of fossil fuel, and we've heard stories about the Ben-Gurion Canal or you know, this pipeline for extraction of natural gas, and Israel and the U.S. wanting to control shipping and distribution of resources, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what gives you hope, Rhonda?
I mean, I think it's the youth. They are just amazing, and they're not going to just accept what, you know, our government tells us is the truth. They're looking for alternative sources, and they're speaking up and standing up. And I'm amazed and impressed, and I'm just hopeful, you know, because of that. I mean, I think if we continue on the path that we're on, we could see a free Palestine within our lifetime, and we could definitely, you know, and with the solidarity, that the discussion of these movements in solidarity, hopefully we see freedom for all peoples, all oppressed peoples in the world.
I've been trying to wrap my mind around what it would feel like. to have an end to this violent control of all the possibilities, right? Mm-hmm. This threat, this bully, like the United States and Israel as a militaristic bully, threatening destruction on anybody who opposes it. And then policy, domestic policy at home, making it illegal to even talk about this critically.
Right.
Educational institutions, universities, people getting fired, and then students standing up and being brutally assaulted by the police and then attacked by Zionist mobs. There was one instance in which a kid at UCLA talked about how the Zionist mob and the Proud Boys were fighting together.
Right. Yeah. If you're aligned with Trump, I mean, it's just me, but there's a problem. I mean, not that Biden's any better, but I mean, I would just look at that or the Proud Boys, you know, which are basically Trump. But yeah, that's insane. Like, why would you feel comfortable with that? I don't understand.
What I'm starting to see is that there's alignment between white supremacist elements and political Zionism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's very clear. And I'm sad and I'm angry that more than 30,000 people, 15,000 of which are children, have had to die. They didn't have to die. They were murdered intentionally. But it's only because of that these things are coming to light. The way that a lot of universities are in collusion with this genocidal project.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, I appreciate you making time to talk to me about these things and let our listeners know. I'm glad that KBOO is making time to recognize the Nakba right now.
Yeah, I appreciate that as well. Thank you for having me.
Indeed, Rhonda. Take care, and hopefully we'll see you in the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. فمرعاً لغزلان ودير لرهبان وبيت لأوثان وكعبة طائف وألواح توراة ومصحف قرآن أدين بدين الحب أدين بدين الحب أدين بدين الحب أدين بدين الحب أنا توجهت ركائبه.
You're listening to KBOO. It's our spring membership drive right now, and if you want to support programming like we just heard, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, you can donate. Go to bit.ly/KBOO, that's bit.ly/KBOO, or text KBOO to 44321 to pledge your support. Our spring membership drive is going to go until about May 25th, and our on-air goal for fundraising is $60,000, and it's listeners like you that help us get there. So make a donation now. Go to bit.ly/KBOO and show your support. Thank you.
على من عداك وقمت ناجيك يا من ترى خفايا القلوب ولسنا نراك أحبك حب عيني.
I'm Molly and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding